Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to convene this meeting of the board and at this time ask our secretary to please call the roll.
Yes, sir. Mr. Cepeda.
Here.
Mr. Edwards.
Here.
Mr. Fitzgerald. Dr. Kortz.
Here.
Mr. McMillan.
Here.
Mr. Mitchell.
Here.
Mr. Montgomery.
Here.
Governor Rauner. Ms. Reyes.
Here.
Ms. Robles. Mr. Robles.
Here.
Ms. Smart.
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dee Dee. Well, I think this is a great tradition we're having or started recently that two times a year we get together, the faculty, the administration, and the Board of Trustees to discuss issues that are pertinent to higher ed. I think it's important to keep these lines of communication open. And so I'd like to thank all of you for making the effort to be here today. Despite some inclement weather, it's great to have you here. Look forward to it. Today we're going to discuss three important issues that greatly impact higher ed: campus inclusiveness and freedom of expression, globalization and immigration in higher ed, and civil engagement in public universities. President Clean, do you have any comments? You'd like to share
just a few. First of all, I'd love to thank all of our colleagues and students, administrators, obviously trustees. We've got some invited participants as well to spend a few hours with the Board of Trustees in their annual retreat to touch on some things that are very sort of vital to the core of public higher education and University of Illinois system as an exemplifier of what that means for the public good, I think has to take these issues on, discuss them, and in a way that is productive, outbound, and collegial. And so we have an opportunity here that is rare, I posit. The clock is ticking already, so I'm going to be very brief, because at 4:40 we all go back to our day jobs, whatever they are. So we don't have long together, but everybody seated here is going to be participating. There's going to be no escape from participating in these discussions, and I'm very excited that we're taking these things on in a proactive way. We're not under duress. We're not in a crisis mode to look at these things. But as you know, the forcing functions of public higher education are in changing. They're in flux. We need new business models. We need new ways of connecting to society. We need new pedagogies, use of technologies, et cetera. And these are important issues. Campus inclusiveness, freedom of expression, freedom of speech, what we do about that. The whole issue of our international participation, obviously things like visa changes, rules changes, and our role in research collaborations writ large, and then civic engagement. These are all things that are in our strategic framework that the board has embraced and put forward, and we have an opportunity here to think through those issues. The goal would be, if we can, to come up with some statements or some positioning for the University of Illinois system, our system, that has some fresh language and represents what we stand for as a group, as a collective group, rather than what we do if something goes wrong or something happens. And so that's a rare opportunity that you can think through what we stand for together. We've got students, as I said, our student leadership group, our deans, our administration directors. We've got the presidential fellows in the room, and of course the trustees that will be participating in this as well. So let's get started. I'd like to mention that we invited three remarkable individuals to come and season our conversation in ways that will have us thinking. And let me introduce them very briefly, and then each of them will give a comment or two. We've been calling them discussants, and I think provocateurs maybe is another term we might want to use in terms of addressing these issues from an external perspective, but perspectives of great experience and depth of knowledge. And so we're delighted at, that they're with us today. One of them is on the phone. I hope I haven't heard his voice yet, but let me introduce them in the order in which they'll be making short interventions to get us started. First of all, we have Dr. Julie Ellison, professor of American Culture and English at the University of Michigan, a former close colleague of mine, and I'm just delighted to be working with her again after a break of about 25 years or something like that. She's a faculty associate in the Department of African and African American Studies, African and Stamps in School of Art and Design. Her work addresses literary and cultural history, emotion theory, civic engagement in higher education, cultural organizations of public humanities. I know from firsthand experience that she's been very much a national leader on the whole issue of how the humanities in public higher education in particular connects to civil society in lots of interesting ways. So Julie will give us our first comments. Next, we have Dr. Naila Nasir, who's with us, who is the incoming president of the Spencer Foundation, Chicago-based organization that is dedicated to supporting education and education research around the world, literally around the world. So obviously very germane to us. Previously, she was a faculty member at UC Berkeley, where she served as vice chancellor for equity and inclusion. Her research focuses on issues of culture, race, and how they influence learning, achievement, and educational trajectories of African-American and other non-dominant students in urban school and community settings. And that's very germane to our thinking about campus inclusive, welcoming cultures. Finally, we're joined by Peter McPherson. Peter, are you there?
I am here.
Hey, we're on a roll. Thank you, Peter. Peter is currently the president of the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities, APLU, that we're obviously a member of, formerly president of Michigan State University, and the head of USAID. He's also previously served as the chair of the board of Dow Jones and Company, which is the publisher, as you know, of the Wall Street Journal. Through his current leadership work at APLU, he connects with university presidents across the country, and has helped to lead the development of several cross-association initiatives, such as Project Degree Completion, the Student Achievement Measure, and the Voluntary System of Accountability. And he's also worked very strenuously to advance federal policies that strengthen public research, a major national advocate for who we are and what we do. So thank you all three for being here. And Mr. Chair, if with your permission, let me invite Dr. Ellison to begin the presentation with a short discussion.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here. I have a color handout. It exists on my academia.edu page. So if you Google Julie Ellison at academia.edu, it's the only item under talks. And I'm sure it will be available in other forms subsequently. Pictures and information. An epigraph. A serious moment for the water is when it boils. Occasionally, there's someone around who understands the importance of this moment for the water. From a poem by Kenneth Koch, One Train May Hide Another. First, what is civic engagement? A standard definition of civic engagement in higher education right now might be this from Peter Levine of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. Note how he links the term active citizens to active verbs. This is the English professor speaking. Active citizens seek to build, sustain, reform, and improve the communities to which they belong, which range from small voluntary associations to the world. Active citizens deliberate with peers to define public problems and then collaborate to address them. In doing so, they honor certain virtues, such as respect for others, and loyalty that does not preclude critical thinking and dissent. Actual work is important. We learn from acting together. Citizens construct or build public goods, tangible goods, and intangible ones like traditions and norms. In doing so, they create civic relationships, which are scarce but renewable assets. In higher ed, this idea of civic engagement is applied to student learning and scholarship. A typical statement of a campus civic engagement mission stresses students as collaborators and civic actors rather than as helping out, which I think is still very common, but there's a subsequent wave. We see community engagement as a necessary corollary of civic engagement. We define community engagement as our college's active role in supporting a mutually beneficial relationship with on- and off-campus community partners. Education with a significant focus on community and civic engagement prepares students for participation in institutions of political and social power. That's from De Anza Community College in Cupertino. With these meanings hovering in our minds, I want to point to three realities on the ground that are going to accelerate, are already accelerating, structural change in colleges and universities. These realities take the form of three new majorities forming in the unsettled weather of our moment, literally and figuratively. All of them come under the heading of the equity imperative, a term used by the Lumina Foundation and others. The majority of high school graduates, this is majority number one, new majority number one, majority of high school graduates are members of historically underrepresented minority groups pursuing education under conditions of structural racism and its effects. Another new majority, and this relates to Peter's degree completion work, is that all of us, oh no, that's number three, sorry. this doesn't relate to Peter's degree completion work. Another new majority is the fact that all of us are living in the near universal reality of the U.S. as a society defined by extreme economic inequality. The top 20% of U.S. households own more than 84% of the wealth, and the bottom 40% combine for 0.3%. Universities will need to find ways of building a sense of the commons on campus while partnering on community economic development by, and I'm quoting Gladstone Hutchinson, a Jamaican economist at Lafayette College here, by awakening the market and social value of community members' latent assets. The market and social value. The third of these new majorities is what's been called by David Scobie the marginalized majority of what used to be called non-traditional college students, working adults pursuing degree completion. Only about a quarter of U.S. graduate students, of undergraduates, now fit the classic profile of traditional 18 to 22-year-old living on campus. Student. The achievement gap between the working adult, part-time majority, and full-time students who reside on campus is very real. What goes unnoticed is how high adult student, working adult student aspirations are. Most students entering community college aspire to either a four-year bachelor's degree or that plus graduate study, according to the National Center of Educational Statistics. The 1947 President's Report on Higher Education, known as the Truman Commission, cites a July 1947 Gallup poll showing that the more education a person has, the more he wants. I've seen this appetite firsthand in College Unbound, a degree completion program based in Providence, Rhode Island. Learning is structured through College Unbound's Big Ten capacities and skills that constitute a set of intensively civic, high-impact learning practices. Importantly, students start imagining themselves as alumni right from the start. This is the kind of edgy incubator unit for marginalized majority education that is indispensable for other kinds of institutions. Finally, three keywords, and each keyword is linked to an institutional practice that can help campus leaders articulate different approaches, different pathways through civic engagement. First, full participation, a term developed by Susan Sturm at the Center for Institutional and Social Change at Columbia Law School. Full participation brings into logical coherence what we habitually split in our daily work into the diversity mission and the public mission. And they occupy different reporting relationships. They go to different meetings. But they come together under that word thrive. So listen for the word. Full participation is an affirmative value focused on creating institutions that enable people, whatever their identity, background, or institutional position, to thrive, realize their capabilities, engage meaningfully in institutional life, and contribute to the flourishing of others. The next I'm not going to spend any time on, but it's really useful. It's called Purposeful Work. It's the name of an initiative at Bates College that supports not only getting students to graduation, but also helping them keep it together afterwards. They decided just following your passion was not having very good results. So this is a really smart middle path. And finally, I'm going to introduce this term, which I don't know if it's a thing yet, but I call it distributed engagement, distributing the public mission around the state through people and beyond. I'm leading an effort to build a national network for, I hope no one's offended, demonetizing and democratizing alumnihood, especially for former students who are not and may never be financial donors, but who are publicly active where they live and work. The vehicle for this is the Citizen Alum Network. We have a little website at citizenalum.org, and there's also writings about this on my academia.edu site. The tagline is doers, not just donors. A new civic alumnihood would help us all learn how the public mission is being lived out and perhaps altered by graduates through listening projects that can be carried out by undergraduate researchers in academic units, especially civically engaged academic units, from which these new engaged graduates have gone forth into the world. The University of Illinois President Andrew Draper, in a speech on the university in 1903, referred to his future graduates as sure-footed citizens. That remains the goal. The water is boiling, and we all understand the importance of this moment for the water. Thank you.
Dr. Nasir will get us going, too.
All right. Set my timer so I don't talk too long. Okay, good afternoon. Really honored to be here. I am a recent transplant to Chicago from California. I've been here a couple of weeks now. and it's really a treat to be here in conversation with you around these issues that are so critical here in Illinois, in California, and in our nation. In preparing for today and reading the somewhat voluminous amount of material that was sent to me, and thinking about this moment in public higher education, it really struck me what a unique and critically important role public institutions hold in our society, and at this time in particular. At best, they are beacons of access and opportunity, educating the public, building knowledge for the betterment of the public good. And I think this notion of the public good needs to stay front and center as we discuss campus inclusiveness and freedom of expression, because educating the public is about creating a healthier, stronger, more humane, and more just society, in addition to moving kind of individuals and families forward. So we had a call to prepare for this conversation today, and two things really resonated with me in President Killeen's framing of my task for this afternoon. First, he said that he wanted to ensure that the University of Illinois was a proactive space of leadership and possibility rather than a reactive space. We're in a time where that visionary leadership is perhaps more important than it ever has been. And second, he said he wanted to avoid jargon and catchphrases that would trigger certain perspectives and conversations that might distract us from the important task of exploring what is possible instead of dwelling on what we already have agreed that we disagree upon. And I think this, too, is critically important. And as an eternal optimist, I believe that in the space of humanity and possibility is where we can move society and our campuses forward. And when I say humanity, I don't intend to homogenize or assume that we are all the same. We come from communities with different histories, different cultural and political ways of being, and we are positioned differently in society along any number of dimensions. My version of what it means to be humane honors and respects difference. So my focus is on the particularly heated topic of free speech and inclusivity on college campuses. Being from UC Berkeley, I've had just a bit of experience with this lately. And so I'm going to speak from several standpoints as I make my comments. I'm going to speak from the standpoint of my own professional background. I'm a learning scientist, an education scholar, a scholar of cognitive development. I study how people think and learn and the types of learning environments that give rise to optimal outcomes. I'm also a scholar of race and identity. I study systems of privilege and marginalization and how they take root in the lives of students and in institutions. I'm a former university administrator at perhaps one of the most challenging and rewarding public university campuses upon which to lead. And I'm currently an Education Research Foundation president, so I've been thinking a lot about the key issues facing education, both K-12 and higher ed, and how we can affect them for the better, with a focus on that, like, what can we actually do, right? I'm speaking from my experience in particular at Berkeley as being a part of the Chancellor's Cabinet and the what we call there the protest response team. That's a real thing. And being really on the front lines, as it were, participating in difficult conversations this past year about the best approach to support free speech on the Berkeley campus, including a listening tour with students from marginalized communities, LGBTQ students, students of color, undocumented students, our student Republican group, about their perspectives and needs regarding free speech and campus climate. And I speak from my experience as the Vice Chancellor of Equity and Inclusion there, where not only did I have the job of working on campus climate issues, but where I also supervised 125 full-time staff. And I think sometimes we forget how deeply campus climate issues impact staff as well as students and faculty. And then finally, I speak from my personal background, because I don't believe we ever really leave this part of ourselves outside the door in board meetings. Even when we don't acknowledge their presence, our personal experiences and histories color how we understand and interact with the world. So I bring to this conversation my personal background as a working class kid from Berkeley, California, with a deep commitment, a city with a deep commitment to diversity and school integration, a mother of three college age-ish kids, and a 12-year-old. For me, being a parent is a really important part of this, because what we want for our own children, the standard that we hold schools, universities, and campuses to when it comes to our own children or our nieces or nephews or grandchildren or whatever, have to become the standard we hold them to for what Lisa Del Pitt called other people's children. Right? So I'm going to start with just some framing around free speech, the controversy that's playing out on college campuses nationally, and the challenges facing universities right now. The free speech movement fought on the Berkeley campus established the right of student groups to engage in political activism and political activity on college campus, and for the freedom of expression regardless of the content of their speech. Obviously, free speech and freedom of expression is a First Amendment right and is a core value we hold as a nation. And many have written about, including many of the articles we read in preparation for this conversation, about the tension between free speech and hate speech. Right, and even broader than that, the tension between free speech and providing a safe campus community. From the legal perspective, this is not really much of a debate. There is simply no way to protect freedom of speech and to police or punish speech at the same time. The professional legal opinion is clear that if free speech is an ideal we hold, then we must hold it at all times, devoid of whether we agree with the content or whether the content is abhorrent to us. That includes protecting hate speech. However, despite the legal clarity, campus administrators have been challenged when faced with very difficult real-world situations. What we saw on many campuses this spring, including my own, was an uptick in the presence of speakers who held and expressed opinions that were not just conservative perspectives on a very liberal campus, but that were openly racist and homophobic and anti-immigrant. Now, alone, the simple presence of these speakers may not have caused the uproar that they did. In fact, places like Berkeley host speakers with very conservative and often controversial views regularly in academic departments. Like the legal scholars, campus communities are pretty clear that all perspectives should be allowed and debated. However, very few people attend academic talks, and there is typically no press involved. So these speakers were different. They were publicly high profile. They brought with them a level of media attention that became somewhat of a tinderbox. Not only did the controversy of these talks get set aflame by the media attention, but they came at a time of political upheaval nationally and in the midst of a great amount of fear and a negative national discourse that had wreaked havoc on the feeling and practice of community on campuses. So campuses were challenged not only to figure out how to live out their unquestioned commitment to free speech, but also to keep the campus community safe in the face of very real threats of violence and indeed violent actions, and to wrestle with how to protect both the value of free speech and the physical and psychological safety of the campus community. Right? That was the challenge. And so I think to really understand and live up to this challenge, we need to keep several things in mind. The first thing that I want you to keep in mind is a question. What would it look like to operate from a place of humanity and a space of possibility? And I want you to kind of hold that thought. There's been much talk in this about this generation of students not being strong enough to withstand a normal amount of hardship and controversy. You know, I'm a parent. I deeply believe people need challenge and personal hardship in order to grow. I sometimes create it on purpose for my own kids. But emotional, physical, and psychological safety is not a luxury that we should just maybe try to provide in learning settings if we can. They're actually fundamentally necessary for optimal learning to occur. We cannot learn in spaces that do not honor our humanity. We have to remain mindful that some students and student communities are simply more vulnerable than others because of their political position or lack of access to a range of supports. First-generation students, low-income students, immigrant and undocumented students, LGBTQ students, students from historically marginalized racial and ethnic groups, students with disabilities. Some of the high-profile speakers that made appearances on college campuses this past year tended to target students from these most marginalized groups, not just verbally, but also online. So while I fundamentally agree that we should not protect students from the range of hardship that growth requires and that life invariably dishes out, I think we have to ask, is the hardship we are asking students to endure equally distributed? And history would suggest not. This is a very big part of understanding for me what's required of us as campus administrators. How do we create environments on our campuses that do not place this undue hardship on our most vulnerable students? Inequality and racial and social class marginalization, both historically and present day, are real. And I bring up these issues of inequality simply to make the point that the playing field in our society and on our campuses is not equal, that our students and we are living in the legacy of many forms of inequality and marginalization. And part of the task is not to hide from the inequality of the past or the way it reverberates into our present, but to be fearless about keeping the inequalities and their effects at the table when a challenge arises on our campus, and to be committed to doing our part to create and enact structures not just of inclusiveness, but of equity. So what does it look like to operate from a space of humanity and possibility with respect to free speech and campus inclusivity? We are in a time where our task is to figure out how to grow our campuses as model communities, as places for civil and respectful discourse, and perhaps more ambitiously, as places where students can explore their beliefs and perspectives, deepen their understandings of themselves and of the world, become truly engaged, educated, well-rounded citizens. And to enact this vision, we have to create intentional campus communities with thoughtful and engaged leadership. We cannot simply respond or react to the pressures from outside speakers or the pressures from student protests. We have to be proactive, wise, humane, and to exercise true leadership, which for me is about creating the structures and systems which allow those in our care to reach their full potential. So with that in mind, while hate speech is protected by the First Amendment and on our campuses by the legacy of the free speech movement, it is an ethical and moral problem for two reasons. And here I'm both an idealist and a pragmatist. It's a problem because it does not align with our values as a nation and as campus communities, and it's rooted in our troubled national past. And it's a problem because students can't live where their full humanity is denied, and staff can't work effectively in spaces where their full humanity is denied. And faculty can't teach where they're worried more about what will cause political waves than about uncovering truth with evidence and pushing a new and edgy conversations in intellectual fields. So the presence of hate speech runs counter to two of our most cherished goals as universities. But the solution is not to ban it or punish those who engage in it. If our goal is more ambitious than just protecting free speech and keeping folks physically safe, if our goal is about honoring the full humanity of all campus community members, which means we want for all kids what we want for our own, and about creating rich spaces for intellectual discourse and dialogue, then we must indeed be more proactive, and we must be stronger, wiser leaders. And so I think in this regard, we may be asking the wrong question. So to some degree, we've been asking if these controversies or if these speakers or if these conversations should be allowed on college campuses. But I think the right challenge is not the if, but the how. How can we create structures and courses and community norms that engage multiple voices respectfully? What are the things we need to have in place before the controversy hits? And that's where leadership comes in. So if we're going to operate from a space of humanity and possibility, the task for university administration is to think about how to do two things. One, how to build a trusting campus community where we can have difficult conversations with love. And I can unpack that in a small group session. And how to structure ways to have these conversations that make them maximally productive. And maybe there's even a third thing in there that comes before those two, which is to find a way to institutionally acknowledge the pain of various forms of social inequality so that we can find ways to honor and meet the needs of all members of our communities. So clearly this is a tall order, but I think it's the work we must do to ensure that our commitment to the public good, to the university spaces as intellectually rich and spaces of learning, exploration, and discovery is borne out. And I think that in some way for me frames what our small, what our task will be for the small groups this afternoon. Thank you.
Dr. McPherson. Peter, you may have to come off mute.
Okay. Yes, I'm here. Well, you're ready, are you? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Let me say, first of all, how unhappy I am that I'm not there. As many of you know, the flights into O'Hare basically have been canceled, and so my plan to leave at 8 o'clock this morning just didn't work. I'm particularly unhappy because, of course, I've, as a former Big Ten university president, I've known and respected that great affection for University of Illinois for all these many years. I've been asked to talk about globalization and immigration, and I'd like to look at it in the following fashion. These are important matters to achieve and do well, first in terms of providing a broad and strong education for students. Secondly, in terms of being able to do the best, the most cutting-edge research. And third, to engage and strengthen the community, the state, region, and beyond. All those are important to get done for the University of Illinois. And, of course, the faculty are so critical to each of those which are mutually reinforcing, I might add, and a strong and effective administration. Now, so the success of those, the globalization, immigration component of that, let me talk about in for each one of those categories. First, the students. Students need to have an education that includes some sense of the world. That's important for them as citizens, but it's important for them in terms of employment. And so how you achieve that, study abroad is certainly one of the ways to do it. At Michigan State, we drove our numbers up so that about 40% of the graduates had a study abroad experience. Now, you need to be sure it's democratized, if you will. It's not just students with a little more resources, but broad. But even then, there were 60% that didn't have such an experience. And how you do that, by the way, I think you can do study abroad. You have to hold the study abroad, at least some programs, down to be relatively inexpensive. But even with large study abroad numbers, you still have substantial people that don't have that experience. You look at internships. Internships are more and more important, whether they be domestic or international, by the way. You need to look at other ways to do it on campus. For example, the undergraduates at Illinois has the largest foreign student bodies in the country, I think fifth in the country, actually. So I'm talking about the whole system. Are they living together? Are they spread around in such a way that all students get to know foreign students and foreign students get to know domestic students? The faculty are key. How you emphasize and celebrate the international experience and efforts of individual faculty is part of all this. I could, of course, talk 20 minutes about each one of these topics. But the student experience, I think to keep in mind how you provide some sense of the world, of the differences in the world, some globalization sense for undergraduates is important to achieve. In terms of research, the world is, the science doesn't know boundaries. Science, intellectual efforts, diseases, atoms, etc. There's no boundaries here. All over the world, things are happening, and you can't close off. You can't, Illinois or this country can't close itself off from what's happening in intellectual pursuits and science around the world. So you need to be connected and engaged to be able to bring out the research that Illinois is such an illustrative history of achieving. There's ways to think about this, but obviously the bringing in foreign faculty, foreign-born faculty, bring for short and long-term stays. It's interesting that the six Nobel Prize winners last year in chemistry, economics, and physics, all from the U.S., all were foreign-born. We have been enriched for generations by foreign faculty coming, and frankly, the universities in your state would just be dramatically less than they are without this foreign faculty. And without the engagement that your faculty has with faculty and intellectual institutions around the world. How you drive that is a whole set of issues that again would take longer than I have, but I think one of the ways to think about this is that your universities have gone through thinking about what are big issues, kind of cross-cutting issues that can capture across the transdisciplinary, across the campus. APLU just finished a report funded by the Kellogg Foundation looking at what public universities should do to produce the food necessary by 2050, both domestically and internationally. And I think you've been doing some thinking about that yourself, but that's the kind of issue that cuts across the geography of Illinois, cuts across your institutions. And I think it's worth thinking about big issues that can capture domestic global efforts. Because, by the way, food is not just enough food to eat, but it's nutrition. It gets into obesity issues, too much and too little food, etc. And the last thing is the engagement of the region, the state, the regions, and beyond. Illinois has this long, really illustrative history. I've always liked the fact that the Erie Canal, which connected from a Buffalo, from the Atlantic to the Great Lakes, one of the big events in our history, opened in 1825 in Chicago, was founded in 1830. From a very early time, the state has been global. And when you look at the Chicago broad area and the corporate headquarters, look at the rest of the state and agriculture and other businesses, it is a global state. And there are discussions, of course, here in Washington and around the country about global, what the global connection should be, but I think no one deny that those global connections are important for the state and for various regions of the state, and how the university contributes to and helps strengthen and drive all that. I mentioned food as a cross-cutting issue, but there are so many more. So when I think about the importance of immigrants, globalization, it is a for the university is key for your to produce the students you need, the research you need to help the region and the state. So a comment or two about Washington and all this. You've heard about the issues, but just a brief rundown. So much of all I've been talking about is people, by the way. The issues in Washington are in many cases about people. I know that Illinois has been a strong supporter of DACA students. Certainly APLU has been a forefront in saying that DACA students should be able to continue to not only have that status, but new students that qualify should be able to achieve that. It looks like, at least within the administration, we sort of go from week to week that that will stay, but although the messages are occasionally mixed, there is a lawsuit out of Texas with some other attorney generals involved about the Constitution, the legality of DACA. But I think DACA is important not just because it's for those individual students, for them it's key, but also because of a judgment that it reflects about the openness of our country. Just 2 days ago, the Department of Homeland Security floated the idea that maybe there should be annual reviews of visas of students. Now we have already indicated what a bad idea we thought that was. We certainly need security, but we need to figure out how to do that in the context of this openness to foreign students, to foreign faculty, and so forth. You can imagine other countries around the world are very interested in foreign students. Australia numbers, Canada numbers are growing dramatically, for example. You can imagine how great it'd be to try to recruit that excellent PhD student in engineering that we want if we tell them every year your visa is going to be under review. So these are important matters, not just for stays of 2 or 3 years, 4 years, whatever, but the short-term visits. It's a part of being engaged intellectually around the world, as I was saying, to start with. Science doesn't have borders. So that's my quick overview. And I think that when you consider the University of Illinois, it does have a strong history in the state and the region, a strong history of global engagement to the benefit of students, research, and the region, and nothing is ever static. There are ways to build on it, and I'm sure you're thinking about it.
Thank you, Mr. McPherson. President Killeen, would you like to introduce our facilitators for the breakout groups?
Yes, well, we're going to go into the breakout groups now, fed by this wonderful family of introductions on these topics. And the facilitator for the you have names and locations to participate. The first group will consider civic engagement in public universities. And the facilitator will be Ed Seidel, who's Vice President for Economic Development and Innovation. The second group will be discussing campus inclusiveness and freedom of expression. And the facilitator for that group is Dean Vikram Amar, Dean of the College of Law at Urbana. And the final group will be considering globalization and immigration in higher education. The facilitator for that discussion will be Presidential Fellow Antoinette Burton. Probably these individuals are known to many in the room. So those are the.
Thank you, Tim. So a few mechanics. We will now recess our Board of Trustees meeting and we'll break out into our assigned small groups. As Tim said, your name tag contains information about which group that you have been assigned. We'll gather back here at 3:20, and each group will have 10 minutes to share their ideas and responses and also to answer questions. So without further ado, please head to your assigned room and begin your discussions. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would please take your seats, we'll commence with the next part of the retreat, which is a discussion of the breakout groups. Each group will have 10 minutes to share their responses to the four questions and also to answer questions. And we'll lead off with Civic Engagement and Public Universities Group. That would be Dr. Seidel, I believe, right?
Sure.
Thanks, Ed.
Sure. Okay. Let's see. Oh, okay.
Thank you. So we had a great session, I would say. I just really enjoyed it. Shall I come up?
Go up to the podium.
Good. Now I can read it as well. So we had a really very deeply engaging session on civic engagement, and I think that the conversations could have gone on for quite a bit longer. In fact, I hope that they actually will. We have some thoughts about how we might pull these together and turn them into something that goes well beyond this retreat. So let me just start with the first about what principles or values reflect what we stand for in relationship to this issue of civic engagement in public universities. So I'll just read through these since it may be a little bit hard to see them. So the first one is about shared learning, including teaching and research, as a vehicle for the university to contribute to society and the public good. The second one is about full participation and inclusiveness, which would impact our core world identity. Third one, shared learning. The idea of shared came up repeatedly. Shared learning, creating opportunities for purposeful work with the community as part of the process. So we did not narrow these down to a set of three or four, but we still have some work to do. The next one, which I think came up over and over again in different contexts, blurred boundaries with intentional integration. And so, in effect, the idea there is that as we think about civic engagement, we have to think about interdisciplinarity, we have to think about diversity of different groups in order to come up with ways to address complex problems in society. So a value that we should hold at the university would be to support the blurring of boundaries and intentionally integrating. And something that I think it does show up at the bottom here, the shared mission of research, teaching, and service. The idea of civic engagement is sometimes discussed in universities, but lumped into the third part, service. And so we were talking about doing this in a much more comprehensive way to elevate the idea of civic engagement as something that just threads all three traditional parts of our usual core missions of research, teaching, and service. The third one is, or the next one here, is service to public good in everything we do. I skipped over one. I'll come back to that. But we discussed this for a while. That we thought was actually extremely powerful if we took it to heart in everything we do at the university, and not just something that we do in a Friday afternoon or something like that, to really think about that. Commitment to purposeful work. And this comes back even to logo that we have for the University of Illinois with the two words learning and labor that President Killeen pointed out. That's already built into our DNA from the very beginning. So purposeful work and the commitment to that. The next thing that skipping down there is occupy multiple roles in our work. That is integration. Back to the idea that it's not one thing we add on, but it's integrated in what we do. Another one is engagement itself is a value for the university. So perhaps I'll just go to the next one after that. So civic engagement, again, what are our different audiences for this issue? The first one is pretty comprehensive. It's everyone. Everyone in all spheres, actually, because universities touch all segments of society, from the government sector to the private sector to citizenry, and also well beyond the university itself, even out to the international context. So we have to think about, in fact, how we might develop the different messages for these different audiences. In particular, to think about among diverse external groups, we have to think about legislators and students. Another one that didn't make this list but was discussed was the idea of alumni as an important aspect of this, which I liked very much in the discussions we'd had earlier about doers, not only donors, among alumni, and to find out really deep ways to engage alumni that are hungry for this kind of engagement, I think. Internal versus external stakeholders, and after some discussion, it was pointed out that perhaps the most important audience is ourselves. What do we do as a university community ourselves? This is something that may or may not actually be held deeply among different faculty groups or students or departments with different cultures, and we have to think very much about how we bring this in ourselves or into ourselves. Just back up just one slide. So another one is replacing the audience, the idea of audience, with partners or stakeholders. So this isn't just the idea that we will engage a community group one day or one week or for a semester, but that these are long-term partners and stakeholders that are part of our community, and we're part of that too. So we have to think about this as long-term sustained engagement. And then the last one, which I think I already got to, the self, our structure and view. How do we incorporate this value into the fabric of the university? And there was some discussion about whether we have to do this first before we can move on, but universities move slowly internally, and so we would need to do this in parallel with other efforts, say with alumni, with public groups, and so on. Okay, the last one. What should be our overall agenda on this issue? For example, on our campuses, in the state, nationally, internationally. Here we had some discussion about agenda having a sort of a little bit of an edge to it. What's our agenda in this? So we also replaced that in some groups with the idea of objectives, for example, or actions that we might undertake in order to achieve the values. And so just reading them out, building an infrastructure for long-term civic engagement, and rethink some things that we do currently to incentivize. How would we make this something that people really want to do rather than something that they sort of have to do? We would like to be a thought leader for the 21st century as a university. And so if we think that the time is right for this and the time it is our time to do this, then we should become one of the leaders. And among other ways we might be recognized for that, become a Carnegie Classified Engaged University. To define purposeful work, especially as a land-grant university, I think this comes a little bit later as well, but we have, as a land-grant university, have a responsibility for this kind of engagement right to the core. Universities have became more and more research-oriented, which I'm a researcher myself, so I appreciate that, but we shouldn't forget this. And so it is our responsibility, and to differentiate ourselves from private universities that may wish to do this, but it isn't as important to their core function. So that's an important aspect. Expanding the vision of what civic engagement is and what that entails, to think about it not merely as engagement with a particular, say, public group, but to think about what all it means in terms of service, learning, and research. How do we take that in? Creating physical and intellectual spaces between disciplines. So one thing we didn't have time to get into in the summary here is the similarity between the interdisciplinarity in science and research and scholarship, where you think you need to bring together people with different areas of expertise in order to address a more complex problem. This is very important also in public and civic engagement. And so how do we create spaces within the universities that take this in, and then spaces to practice and reflect? One thing that also didn't make it was to have students to be able to have places where they can practice and experience this, and also to experience failure in these events as well. That's something universities don't often promote as a value, that it's okay to fail, but I think that's an important aspect that we should think about here. This is about learning in life, and life involves failures. Creating opportunity structures that allow folks to come together for dialogue, discussion, discourse, and action. Really importantly, action, not just talking about things, but what? How do we create actions that allow us to develop these ideas and put them into practice? And then last one, entering into relationships and diverse partnerships. Again, the idea that the diversity is key to this, to success, particularly in society, which is comprised of, by definition, of all the diversity of the people that make it up. And so to embrace that and to think about these as long-term relationships. Any comments from the others?
Comments or questions for Dr. Seidel? I just have one question. Could you explain the Carnegie classification to me, please?
So there is apparently a Carnegie classification for an engaged university. Perhaps Julie, you have a comment about exactly what's entailed in that.
Yeah, it the Carnegie presides over classifying universities. You know, research intensive, and you know these ways of characterizing universities. They were the folks who kind of presided over that process. And really, I think, out of the work of Campus Compact coming out of, you know, starting in the 80s and into the 90s, people came up with the idea because there was so much interest in, well, how do you get this to the institutional level? So you may have a president who's really for it, but, nobody else is, or you may have some, faculty who are very engaged, but it hasn't affected the whole university. So how do you have a set of measures, a set of tests even, or sort of criteria an institution has to meet to be engaged? So things like, are you talking about tenure and promotion policies for a publicly engaged scholarship? How would that work? And curriculum, right? Is there a way for going from a first-year experience to a senior capstone with internships mixed up, to be really high-quality kind of scaffolded sequential learning that departments commit to offering, right? So I was not part of that process at my own university myself. But I know in the beginning there were ways to, like, check boxes, saying, oh, yeah, we're talking about tenure and promotion. But John Saltmarsh, who's a good buddy in the civic engagement arena and runs the New England Research Center for Higher Education, Resource Center for Higher Education, was tasked with the job of, like, closing all the loopholes. So now I think it's really the most important thing is the process of pulling people together around the university and figure out, well, okay, we're doing this here, but are we doing this here? Or are things we need to connect up? Is there something we're missing? And it can be specific to a particular type of institution. So if you're an institution that's really sees first-gen students or working adults as really important, well, are you offering night classes, right, or helping with childcare or something? So it's going to be particular to the type.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Seidel.
Thanks. I'd like to thank Julie for inspiring us to get started and to Eileen for turning stream of consciousness into coherent bullet points.
Our IT folks are doing a great job. Next group, discuss the issue of campus inclusiveness and freedom of expression. This was the group with which I participated. Dr. Vikram Amar led our group. Tremendous job on the refereeing. Take my hat off to you.
Thank you, Tim. These are challenging topics. Thankfully, we had Dr. Nasir to help us as well. We did stick to three answers to each of the big questions. Not just because that was what we were told to do, and as a constitutional lawyer, I kind of take rules seriously. But because so much of the hard work is prioritizing and discerning consensus. So I think these are not presented in any particular order, but all of these had broad support among our group. So the principles or values that we want to stand for with regard to inclusiveness and freedom of expression include acknowledgement of individual's entitlement to respect and dignity. So respect for all members of the community, respect for others, people who have competing points of view, acknowledgement that differences sometimes create a special vulnerabilities in certain individuals. So to treat people not just as undifferentiated masses, but as individual persons who are entitled and worthy to respect. At the same time, we can't sacrifice full and fair and robust diversity of thought, expression, and ideas. We want to really promote that. We recognize sometimes that creates conflict. Sometimes that conflict is constructive. It's healthy. And we don't want to shy away from that. So we want a strong statement that we believe in robust and diverse ideas and intellectual debate. Third, we want to acknowledge that universities do more than simply promote and or allow speech to take place. The First Amendment requires that. People have rights. We got to respect those. But we want to move beyond a purely rights-based approach to at least acknowledge that universities, public universities, have other things they could do. They can take steps to help individuals or groups who feel particularly aggrieved by someone else's fully protected First Amendment expression. Sometimes it's appropriate for the university to acknowledge someone's right to do something, but to weigh in and say, but we don't agree with their message, and here's why. So moving beyond a pure rights platform is something we want to embody in our principles. Next slide. So this one was both the easiest and the hardest because, as one of my colleagues put it, who's not our audience? Who's not our constituency? So we kind of cheated on this one by lumping people together. But we did want to highlight the importance of speaking directly to people who are currently part of the university and who've been through the university, and at the same time have in mind prospective students, prospective faculty members, prospective staff members who will be part of the community, and we want to make sure they understand what we're doing and get the message. And then beyond that, there's the legislature, there's the media, there's social media, there's the business community. I don't think we actually mentioned that, but I don't think anyone would object to that, et cetera. So this was, as I say, kind of easy and hard, but those are the three we came up with. And finally, as to our agenda, believe that we don't do a good enough job of educating students when they come in about the history and value of freedom of expression and the need to express one's or exercise one's rights responsibly and the harm that can be done if they don't do that. So we have a nod to it in this and that, and we try. It's not as if we have never tried, but we want to go back and look to see how we can build this into early, coherent, sophisticated, effective education of members of the community, especially students, but also faculty and staff. And there's got to be some kind of reinforcement of it. It can't be something you learn when you're 18-year-olds and a freshman, and then you never hear about it again 4 years there or 5 years there. So we want some consistency. Related to that consistency is the second idea of each of the three universities looking to see whether it makes sense to create a climate work group create some continuity over time. And we have a lot of ad hoc committees that are responsive to particular events. We have some committees that deal with diversity and the like. But something that really focuses on this intersection of speech and mutual respect and have that as a more possibility of a more standing entity into which some other groups might that are currently operating might feed. And then the final objective or agenda item that we agreed upon was to be more transparent so that members both in the community and the outside world can understand why we did what we did with respect to a particular dispute, what our decision was, and how the process was made, and what the factors that were that bore on those outcomes. Because I'm going off script here, but the Berkeley Ann Coulter debacle. I don't think most people really understood exactly the bind that the administration was in there, and the timeline, and the credibility of certain threats. And so it's easy to pick on people when you don't know exactly what went down. And I think if we provide a little more transparency, it'll actually redound to our advantage. So with that, I'll open it to any questions anyone has. And I want to thank my group and my scribe as well. Tim?
Questions or comments? Okay, Dr. Mark.
Did you talk about deliberation and deliberative, training in deliberative process?
With respect to what? Deliberative process of what?
Well, the National Issues Forum creates these guides, which are just, focus grouped, tried out in every possible situation, really tested. And they and the Kettering Foundation and other people will train, students, staff, faculty, citizens, in how to deliberate about a particular issue. And their issue guides, so I've used the one in my class. My class created a deliberative event, my higher ed class, on what college means.
I don't think we got down to the level of technique. So I was actually just talking to Dr. Killeen, Roberta Killeen, about techniques for facilitating better interaction between people who have differences of opinion and the like. So I think some of those things we might incorporate in an educational component, but we kept this at a slightly higher level than that.
If it became a pervasive practice across roles and constituencies.
If what became? Again, clarity.
The deliberative process.
But what does that mean? That's the problem. So you put that in some kind of a document, and people like me, lawyers, say, well, what the heck does that mean?
It's a way of finding out what people really disagree about. It doesn't. There's things like deliberative polling and deliberative budgeting, which do have a particular outcome, but there's also issue-based a reflection. And the advantage of the guides is that they include kind of forced choices. It says, there's three things, this and this, and you're always, trying to grapple with something that you partly agree with and partly don't disagree with. So it complicates the.
I think it would be a helpful aspiration
distributed across an organization. It would be an important skill and further that entry level. When students arrive.
Right, as I said, as a component really of that education, that makes a lot of sense.
Other comments or questions? Okay, thank you, Dr. Morgan. Great job as moderator.
Thank you, sir.
Our last presentation is on the subject of globalization and immigration in higher education, and we have Dr. Burton to present.
Thank you. Before I go through our slides, I want to remark upon the fact that all the reading that was gathered for you was the work of many hands, but it was particularly the labor of Phyllis Baker, the Special Assistant to the President. So if we could thank her for the intellectual basis for all of this thinking and talking. So in our group, we talked about how to be very specific and intentional with respect to the arguments in favor of the centrality of globalization and immigration to an institution like the University of Illinois. And so the principles and values, we also spent some time reducing our very long lists, Ed, into the directed three or four categories. The first argument is that globalization and immigration are crucial to the pursuit of excellence in all of our core missions, which included research and education and learning and public engagement. To recognize that economic prosperity and sustainability depend on attracting the very best minds, and linked there is the connection between a borderless world and access, inclusivity, and diversity for all students, staff, and faculty. There was a kind of sub-theme of reciprocity emerging across our three slides. And on this last one, we wanted to be sure that we as an institution make the connections between what are often seen as maybe domestic American issues, access, inclusivity, and diversity on the one hand, and what might be considered more international challenges like globalization and immigration. Those are not separate buckets. They are often treated as different domains, but they are deeply interconnected. So those are our three main values. We really struggled, too, with the audiences. We had a big, long list, and we tried, like others, to kind of characterize them into categories. So immigrant and international students, scholars, and faculty themselves, we thought, were really important audiences for this issue, given the, frankly, trauma that many of our colleagues at all levels of the institution have experienced in the wake of threats to their capacity to move across borders. We felt that it was really important to be empathic about their experiences and to recognize that they're a major audience for institutional messaging. Not sure these two categories necessarily, they bleed one into the other. So-called public stakeholders, lawmakers, the federal government, including Homeland Security, and maybe even the Board of Trustees yourselves. And then private interests, quote-unquote, corporate leaders, even alums and donors and multinational employers. So we echo here, I think, some of the other audiences that came up in the other slides, and we tried to kind of put them into thematic groups like that. And then lastly, our overall agenda, people in the group were very invested in thoughtful communication strategies. There was a desire to emphasize the history of the positive impact of globalization and immigration, you know, obviously in U.S. history writ large, but also in the institutional histories of our universities. Those communication strategies could include political advocacy and, again, these links among access, affordability, and excellence. This best minds question and its connection to the borderless world, I think, is refracted through that conviction. And then back to this question of integration and reciprocity, Ritu was very articulate on this point. We need to socialize all students to acquire global competency, not just integrate the international students in our communities, but also convey to our own so-called domestic students the urgency of engaging and integrating and assimilating with international students. There was also a really interesting call to diversify our international pipeline, and we had an invocation of the mission across the border to the University of Mexico and the ways in which there's a lot of, as someone put it, a lot of brain power that we're not actually mobilizing to bring to Illinois. So that's us. Thank you. Whether Peter has anything, it's a great disadvantage on the phone over here. McPherson is over here. No.
First of all, questions or comments for Dr. Burton?
I just a friendly amendment.
Oh, yes, please.
On the audience.
Yes.
A primary one is citizens of the state, and in particular, parents.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Burton. I think now we're going to ask our special guests to, if they would like to make any final comments. Dr. Ellison, would you like to go first?
Oh, I think I've talked so much. I should. I probably shouldn't. I don't think I have anything to add.
Dr. Nasser?
I think I would just say, you know, as you all move these ideas forward and think about how they're going to become instantiated in plans or processes or structures moving forward, just to this point, I think was made in our session that was really important about transparency, and I think just iterating those plans through multiple segments of the community so that when you have your final final whatever it is product, that it lands well with your communities and you get a good amount of buy-in. So.
Thank you. Mr. McPherson still on the phone?
Well, of course, I'm sorry that I haven't been there to get all the richness that I know I would have heard and been part of. One quick comment. I think part of the audience, as was discussed a bit in our group, is the university community itself. It is when you put together something like this, you're talking to a range of outside audiences, but you're also talking about what you are and really your aspirations, for yourself. And it seems to me that all the things that you have gone through there in the last few years, the budget and various leadership changes and so forth, that it's important for you to understand what really great place you are and what aspirations you need to have to be even stronger.
Thank you, sir. And I'd like to thank all participants. I'd like to say how much I enjoyed the lively discussion in our group, and it's really always gratifying for our board to be able to spend time with the members of the faculty and staff to hear your concerns of and visions for the university. of Illinois system. We have an incredible pool of intellectual talent to tap into, and that's always a great pleasure to do so. So thank you all for participating. Any board members have anything to add?
I would like to just add one very short thing.
Please.
And that is, regardless of whether we agree, disagree, we come up with the action plans, the one thing that I've seen it every time, but especially even this time, is the amount of passion and commitment that everyone that was in the room has for this university. And it's just, it's really, it's so, I mean, I know it, but every time I feel it, it just is great. So I just want to.
Thank you. Very well said.
Mr. Chairman? Sure.
Sir.
I just wanted to commend the talent that you brought to us as resource people. We thought you guys were really very helpful.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. I guess now, Tim, I'll turn it over to you. Do you have any comments?
There's someone behind
in the
you
back.
That wanted.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I have some breaking news on this topic, actually. So in civic engagement, Peter Schiffer has pointed out to me that UIUC is already a Carnegie Engaged University. Wow. So we're making progress already.
Just like
everyone. Yeah.
There's more work to be done. However, there's more work to be done. I want to be clear.
Yeah, I'd like to make it just a few comments, really. To thank the board for hosting this retreat, obviously to thank our distinguished external discussants, everybody who's been here and engaged, and you're exactly right, Trustee Smart, there is no lack of passion and commitment and energy on display. Thanks for the people who prepared the materials and the readings and the board office and so on. I think as I've been listening, and I was involved in one of the breakouts, it's actually wonderful to be not fretting about budgets, but actually thinking and acting like we are the intellectual powerhouse that we really are, and embracing and taking on the challenges of our times. The land grant system was designed and created to connect to the public mission and the public good, and these are all issues that are central to that. In the breakout session I was recalling our seal, which says learning and labor. And one of the things that was obvious, actually, even in the opening statements, is that learning was a very much a connective theme that went all the way through everything. So taking this moment to reflect, I think, is extraordinarily valuable. And I think we made a lot of progress. Obviously, there's more to distill and, think through. But on the issue of civic engagement, it's clear that it's almost a defining principle rather than an end goal or a derivative product of in service. But it's got to speak and sing to our missions of research, scholarship, and service as well. Lots of active strategies on display, and thanks to Julie Ellison, I think the issues of full participation, purposeful work came back again and again and again. The meaning of work, civic alumni-ship, students as collaborators, and making sure that people thrive in these settings, but in the process whereof learning, and learning with all stakeholders. I think that was a very exciting session. On the area of campus inclusiveness and freedom of expression, it's really important for us to grapple with these issues. And I really enjoyed all of the discussions preceding and Vic's commentary. I highlighted particularly to move beyond a purely right-based approach, which I didn't understand initially, but it's, yes, the First Amendment, we're going to obviously embrace and do, but we can move beyond the First Amendment. And it touches back to what Naila Nasir reminded. It's how, not if, in many ways. And we've got to take this humane, proactive worldview of what it means to be a university in this evolving sphere of activity. And again, learning was evident in that discussion. It's learning through the processes and learning through the discussion, the discourse around these very important and very timely issues. And I think also a deeper understanding of how individual groups and individuals might be perceiving life and celebrating those differences and not just appreciating them but understanding them at a deeper level, I think is something that sang out of that particular group. And I think that's very important because that sings to our learning and labor motto, I think, in a fundamental way. And then on the global principles, pursuing excellence, acting politically if needed, recognizing that our talent base is global and international. It's not even a question. It is fundamentally. And if I remind the board members, if you look at just the names of the 250 faculty who got promoted, or just look at their names, and you know that we are indeed a truly global institution. And those are scholars of high recognition and impact. So we are intrinsically global. We have to act that way. We have to work that way. And Peter McPherson's comments about students and then the role of international connections with cutting-edge research as being natural for us, and then also the impact on the regional economies. And in other words, it's benefits, the benefits of global engagement flowing back not just to the stature of the university but to the region in which we're embedded are very important. And Peter also emphasized learning. So if there's one word, remember in our strategic framework, we started with these six-word sentences. We started with Hemingway, "You'll be proud of us, Julie." "Baby shoes never worn for sale," which was this classic six-word. We ended up with a four-word sentence. I think the one word coming out of today is learning. And it's in our motto, and it actually threads through all of these important issues. And that provides us a grounding, a platform to... that I think is really deeply appreciated. So I think we can take this information, this material, and start drafting some statements for the University of Illinois. I promise the board that we're going to work with you closely on this, because if this is going to be masthead material for us, for the University of Illinois system, it's got to be vetted, exposed, discussed appropriately. But I think we made a tremendous start personally on this today. So I'd like just to invite a round of applause for our three discussants who who did exactly what we all hoped they would, and we knew they would because of their expertise and their base and their full-blown participation, I think. And I think you know a little bit more about the University of Illinois. We certainly appreciated that effort. So those are my closing comments, Mr. Chair.
Wonderful summary. Thank you, Tim. Any other comments, questions? All right. I guess we would entertain a motion for adjournment.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The ayes have it. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.